There's a new neighbor in town. The Lutheran Federal Credit Union is open and ready to serve members of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Lutheran Federal Credit Union provides checking and savings accounts, home, car, and personal loans, on-demand mobile banking, 30,000 ATMs, and 5,000 in the co-op shared network. You'll find the modernized banking experience you need with excellent customer service and security you expect at LutheranFCU.org. LutheranFCU.org.
Most of the time, there's not an effort to engage in your argument in any good faith. People will just paint you as a homophobe. So it really has just kind of narrowed and shriveled the bounds of discourse.
My grandmother used to say, don't be so open-minded that your brains fall out. There are some scholars who would really like something to be true who unfortunately become too open-minded, too uncritical.
If I'm looking inside myself for strength, it will fail. But that's not actually where my strength comes from, that Christ is greater than my heart.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love Issues Etc.
It has to be a difficult task, writing an obituary or treating someone's life after they have died, especially when someone is as accomplished as this woman was, Pat Summitt, the winningest coach in the history of Division I college basketball, really in a lot of ways is remembered for reshaping sports, for what, a gold medal win as a coach in the Olympics. And a record that has been unrivaled by anyone else. But it's also possible when someone's that accomplished to leave out important details. You try to hit the highlights if you're writing an obituary, but you also want to talk about what made a person like Pat Summitt tick. Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly joins us. We're going to talk about media coverage of the life and the faith of Pat Summitt. Then we're going to turn to our weekly series with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer, Christ in the Old Testament Today, Psalm 41, O Lord, Be Gracious to Me. Terry Mattingly is a regular guest. He's Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate. He's also founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
You saw something in a tribute piece in Baptist Press about Pat Summitt that you didn't find in the rest of the media coverage.
Yeah, I did. And it was actually one detail in a very complex picture. The Baptist Press piece emphasized something that happened at the end of Pat Summitt's life, or near the end of her life, in 2012, which was a joint baptism service that she was a part of, where she was baptized with her son Tyler Summitt. And I saw that, and that made me very curious. I thought I knew a lot about Pat Summitt since I had lived in East Tennessee before. And I think it's important for people to understand that this legendary coach of the Lady Volunteers basketball team for 40 years, and by the way, her win total was 1,098, which is more than any other coach in the history of Division I basketball, male or female. So she's numero uno on the wins list in serious college hoops, and not just among females, but among basketball, period. I thought I knew a lot about her, and I was intrigued by this baptism detail, so I wrote an initial piece about it. But then I also saw that her funeral service was going to occur at a United Methodist congregation. And the minute I saw that, I began to understand why people were so tense about this situation. Pat Summitt was a lifelong United Methodist. She was raised rural United Methodist in the South, which in the 50s and 60s, folks, the Methodists were going to church, if you get my drift there. That's pretty serious evangelical Christianity, and still is in large parts of the South. That's not the Methodism you read about in the newspaper all the time with a lot of the trendier items from the Northeast and the West. Summitt was a serious United Methodist. The Baptist Press piece made it sound like she was a member of a Baptist congregation at the end of her life when she wasn't. Her son was, and she attended there from time to time. But all of that was to say there was this complex relationship between this woman and her faith even in a secular university setting, and she was quiet about her faith. But I interviewed one of her former pastors, and he put it bluntly, she never forced her faith on anybody, but she wasn't hiding it either. It was a part, very much a part of who she was. And I was just intrigued that it didn't show up, you know, in any of the mainstream press coverage of her life until just within the last couple of days. And I wrote a second piece for Get Religion about this as I worked on my own column. The great Washington Post columnist Sally Jenkins, who co-wrote a number of books with Pat Summitt, including the autobiography Summitt Up. Jenkins wrote a wonderful piece that took Summitt's faith very seriously and linked it in a way that I thought was totally appropriate to the Christian emphasis on the dignity of the elderly and of people who are struggling with these diseases like Alzheimer's disease. It was a wonderful piece. You don't have to agree with everything theologically that Sally Jenkins said in it to realize that it was a first-person commentary on the life and the death of Pat Summitt that took her faith seriously.
Okay, the task of writing a tribute piece or even a lengthy obituary is a challenging journalistic task.
Right.
I mean, you try to sum somebody up and say what makes them tick, in essence. Could it be, in this case, that simply there was just too much to say about Pat Summitt?
Well, that's a very good point, and I would never claim that her faith was something that, you know, had to be like at the top of the story or it had to be the major element. I mean, it's impossible for people who don't know much about women's sports in America to understand how important this woman was. I mean, she helped create the world of modern women's sports beginning in the pre-Title IX era. I think the best way to sum it up for listeners is that, you know, there's this award, the highest award you can give to a citizen in the United States is the Presidential Medal of Freedom. That's the tip top. Well, there are four people in history from the sport of basketball who have received this award, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And that's John Wooden, the great coach of UCLA who won like 12 or 13 titles, Dean Smith of the University of North Carolina, equally known as a coach and as an educator, the great Bill Russell of the Boston Celtics who, 13 titles, 12 titles, ridiculous career in the NBA, and the fourth person is Pat Summitt. Now, when you're in that quartet, that's pretty lofty territory. There's so many details I could tell you about the life of Pat Summitt, but here's the point that gets back to what you were saying. In the official obituary posted at the Pat Summitt Foundation, you know, of like 700, 800 words, her family's own summation of her life. Wouldn't you think that would be like a rather basic text to consult?
Yeah, if you're a journalist, you're going to read that one.
If you're a journalist. And it's right there online. It's on page one of the Pat Summitt Foundation. And it mentions the baptism, what the baptism meant to her and Tyler, and it has a quote from Tyler Summitt who says, "For 64 years, my mother's life was based on her relationship with her Lord and Savior Jesus Christ." Now, notice that 64 means her whole life. In other words, Tyler didn't think that baptism service meant that was when his mother became a Christian. He was saying, we did that together as a statement of our public faith and unity with each other. My mother was a Christian her whole life, is what he's saying. The Knoxville News Sentinel poured out, as they should have, they poured out thousands of words about this woman's life in the first 2 days after her death. As a woman is probably more popular in East Tennessee than Peyton Manning, and that would be pretty hard to do. ESPN had page after page after page of features, including at one point I counted something like 12 mini documentaries and video interviews about the passing of Pat Summitt, other than one quick reference on the Mike and Mike radio show where they read Tyler Summitt's statement about his mom. I didn't see any references to her faith or whatever. But when you read her autobiography with Pam Jenkins, the religion is in there. The faith is in there. And the questions she's asking when she's diagnosed with Alzheimer's, all of this, she linked it all immediately to her struggles and to her life of faith. And at one point she says, one thing I've learned through all of this is how big God is.
There's also the timing of her baptism there with her son, which is late in life. And, you know, people who know that they're facing the end of their life and are aware of it usually get down to things that are most important to them.
Right. And I heard people, I received emails from people who interpreted that both ways. I interpreted it as very important that this was a year after the diagnosis of Alzheimer's. It's literally like 3 or 4 weeks after she chooses to step down or had to step down as coach of the Lady Vols, which must have been an astonishingly painful decision for her, that she just didn't, her mental abilities didn't allow her to remain coach. And that's when that baptism occurs. That's very, very symbolic territory in her life. I heard other people say, though, that they thought that was kind of sad, taking advantage of a woman who had Alzheimer's disease. Well, if you follow the interviews with Pat Summitt and you see her up speaking at the ESPY Awards and ESPN, it's clear that Pat Summitt is affected by her disease at that point in her life, but she's still doing lots of public appearances, lots of public work, and is still very much a part of the crusade against Alzheimer's disease. I don't think anybody forced Pat Summitt to get baptized with her son.
Does this, and we've talked about this many times, of course, we've got this ghost, as you call them.
Right.
This ghost that lurks through much of the coverage of Pat Summitt's life and death. Does this signal something, a blind spot, that the media has in general about very accomplished people?
I think in this case it didn't help that in an accurate sense of the word, Pat Summitt is also a feminist icon, and justifiably so. She is arguably one of the two or three people on the Mount Rushmore, it's not even full yet, of women's athletics in the United States. Pat Summitt, at a couple of points, was seriously considered to be hired as the coach of men's basketball teams in the United States, of serious men's basketball teams. She played on the first women's Olympic team in basketball and coached like the second or third one, won the gold medal as a coach in 1984. I think it's hard for some people in the press, especially those who are looking at this as a female hero, as a feminist hero, I think it's hard to say, and oh, by the way, she was active in churches all through her life, very active in the United Methodist Church. Here's what she had to say about her faith. I'm not sure that that fits the image that a lot of people wanted in terms of claiming Pat Summitt as a hero, but I see it as a part of the complexity of who this woman is.
So it might have been just judged too jarringly inconsistent with what the rest of what was being written about her?
I guess, and I understand that if you're talking about, you know, a 700-word story. But if you've got thousands of words and a dozen or more stories, and you're devoting page after page to this woman, I think you can probably make room for it. So when I began to hear all the layers of this story, I immediately began working on my own column, which will start coming out here in the next couple of days in American newspapers on Summitt, kind of trying to place that baptism in the context of the whole of her life of faith. And I interviewed one of her early Methodist pastors in Knoxville, someone who knew her from the time when she wasn't famous at all to when she became very famous, you know, during that decade. And the pastor who, by the way, that as an infant baptized Tyler Summitt, you know, so it was very close to the family.
Let's talk a little bit about it from the angle of sports reporting, because she's going to be reported on by kind of the broader press, of course, but she's going to be the big story in sports reporting and sports stories throughout the year. Is there something in sports reporting that may be a little more amenable to covering a religion angle? After all, I mean, religious symbolism, sometimes to the point of superstition, permeates professional sports.
Well, you would think that, but it seems to be getting, even on figures as popular and as mainstream as Steph Curry, the religious element of his life is right there. He won't let you not notice it. Yet people still have a tendency not to notice it. I had a second piece in Get Religion later in the week, which was the huge story of the superstar Kevin Durant of the Oklahoma Thunder, him announcing that he was going to take his talents to the Golden State Warriors. And Durant is a very outspoken Christian. And yet in the coverage of that, there were a few passing references to the fact that in 2010, Steph Curry, Andre Iguodala, and Kevin Durant became very close friends on the U.S. national team, and that these men used to have chapel services, they called them, just the three of them every day before games. And whatever chapel service meant, it would have been nice if someone had asked what that meant. I at the very least assume that's Bible study and prayer, you know, between the three of them. And when the Golden State Warriors tried to get Durant to leave Oklahoma and come to the Warriors, who do you think they sent to talk to him that day? Well, two of the guys on the plane were Steph Curry and Andre Iguodala. And it's very apparent that they made appeal to him at the level of their friendship and said, you know, we have this very tight bond, come join us. And believe it or not, there were news accounts about that just let the word chapel kind of go flying by with, like, no mention at all that this bond between the three of these guys might have had something to do with Durant's decision. And I think it's crucial to say that nobody is claiming that that's the only reason. I mean, yeah, he wants to play on a championship team. He likes the style of basketball, and they're going to pay him millions and millions of dollars. But, folks, Oklahoma City was in a position to pay him more. There were still elements of Durant's decision that were kind of mysterious. What was his motivation? What changed in his mind and in his heart concerning this decision? I don't know how you look at the facts about that without raising this faith question, whether or not his faith relationship shared Christian beliefs and life with these two other members of the team didn't have something to do with it. But we'll see if that turns into a story or not. At this point, at the very least, it's a ghost.
So with only a minute here, I take it that with what you're working on, you're trying to not so much correct the record, but simply fill in that piece of Pat Summitt's life.
That's exactly right. It would be wrong to try to paint her as some sort of evangelist or something. She was not that. She was a basketball coach, a mastermind, a genius, and a national icon of basketball in a secular context. Yet there's one other statistic from her life that hints at her relationship with her players. She was there 40 years. She became coach when she was 22 at the University of Tennessee. 100% of her athletes graduated from the university. That implies a certain level of concern and personal care that goes way further than how good is your jump shot. And that's a part of who Pat Summitt was. And tucked down in there was the faith that was one of the cornerstones of her life throughout all of it. And it's part of the picture. Paint the picture.
Terry Mattingly, a senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, and founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Glad to be here.
When we come back, we're going to look at Psalm 41, one of those psalms that is like a script for the betrayal and the passion of Jesus. Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will be our guest. It's our series, Christ in the Old Testament.
The church's music from the 2nd century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The 6th century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues, etc.
Athanasius, Bishop of Alexandria in the 4th century, was known for boldly confessing Jesus Christ as both true God and true man. This is what we do at St. Athanasius Lutheran Church in Vienna, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C., continuing this historic confession of our Savior, who died for us and now comes to us in word and sacrament. If you live in the D.C. area or just visiting, come join us. For more information, find us on the web, St. Athanasius Lutheran Church.
Do you have a student finishing up eighth grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.